Has this ever happened to you? You wake up, look at your phone, scroll through the news for a minute or two, and then think, wow, how did we get here? Well, that's the question we tackle every week on NPR's Throughline podcast. We tell you the surprising stories of the people who made our history.
Carl Sagan was in people's living rooms talking about the wonders of the universe, making science feel personal and important to an everyday person.
Listen to Throughline from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
In Israel, military and intelligence officials are writing letters to the government. They want a ceasefire in Gaza.
We have the feeling that the government wants this war to last forever.
The reasons they say are political. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also, we'll hear about a new policy in Ghana meant to stop gold from being smuggled out of the country.
They want to show that they have things under control, which they don't.
And tensions between France and Algeria dash hopes for a diplomatic reset.
The French would like to say, you know, let's start with a clean slate, but we cannot start with a completely clean slate because history is what it is.
Plus, a trip to the record stores in Tijuana.
This is a classic rock band from the 1960s that everybody listened to.
That's all ahead today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We are broadcasting today from KPBS in San Diego. A federal court in Denver this week convicted a former member of the military in Gambia in West Africa on charges of torture. It is a rare prosecution, a trial in the U.S. over human rights crimes that were committed overseas.
After the verdict yesterday, the head of the Justice Department's criminal division made it clear that the United States would not be a safe haven for human rights violators. Here's Matthew Gagliotti.
You cannot hide here. We can and will prosecute you if you come to the United States after committing atrocities abroad.
It's an important legal case in the U.S. It's even bigger news in Gambia. Gambian investigative journalist Mariam Sankanu has been in Colorado covering the trial. She reports for The Republic, an online news outlet based in Banjul, Gambia's capital. I asked Sankanu for her reaction when the guilty verdict was announced.
For me, I was looking around the room and trying to read it and looking at the victims who were sitting and watching him and seeing the victims crying and calling that a moment of basically tears of joy for them. I think that was really interesting for me to see, knowing the history of Gambia and how so many victims are still fighting for justice.
So there were a lot of Gambians and a lot of the defendant's victims in the courtroom there.
Yes, there were a lot of us.
So the defendant was Michael Sankoria, as you've said. Who is he and exactly what has he been convicted of?
So Michael Sankoria was a jungler. Basically, junglers were part of the army initially. And what they essentially did was, if you know the history of Gambia, we had a dictatorship. And our former president, Yahya Jammeh, who's currently on exile, had done so many atrocities. And so the junglers are basically executioners. They did his work for him, including killings, tortures, disappearing people.
And a jungler is a nickname for those people who went after supporters of the attempted coup and in some cases tortured them, a jungler.
Yes, in that attempted coup and other crimes. So Korea in the United States has not been tried for all of those crimes because the United States basically has the Extraterritorial Torture Act. So they specifically tried him on tortures that he participated in 2006. So in 2006, we had a failed coup plot and there were individuals from the military, civilians, different people from different walks of life who were arrested, imprisoned, tortured, forced to confess. So Korea is basically part of the group, the hit squad, the junglers essentially, who were torturing individuals and forcing them to confess to have participated in the coup.
What is the significance of this in Gambia, that one of these junglers has been held to account in a U.S. court?
Like I always say, and I believe most Gambians say, the main significance is how much pressure this would put back on the Gambian government itself. This is the third one that has happened so far. We have had convictions in Germany, in Switzerland, and now in the United States. So essentially what this does is to just put pressure on the Gambian government. That we would also have prosecutions in Gambia because there are also still people like Korea who are in the Gambia who have not been tried yet and victims are waiting. So we hope that this puts more pressure on the government to also do more.
How did Michael Song Corea end up in the United States?
So Corea in 2016 fled. He had a diplomatic visa essentially, which he used in September, but also used it in December following the fall of the regime. When Jammeh was out of power, he came into the United States. And then they were able to track him down at some point when the United States knew he was here. And then they were able to finally trace him through Western Union. And then he was arrested outside his apartment in Colorado. And then also victim organizations started advocating more and more for him to be indicted for crimes that he has already committed back home. And the United States picked it up and he finally had his own time in court last week.
And what was the defense that Michael Song Corea's attorneys put up here that they argued that, you know, he was not guilty of this torture?
Yes. So Corea has pleaded not guilty to all counts. He had given testimonies where he initially said he had not participated in any tortures. And then at an immigration court, he had testified that he participated in only one torture and that victim passed away in 2021. So then there are inconsistencies in what he said. But as far as in the court, the defense has used a coercion and under duress defense to say that Corea, although he may have done what he had done, he was coerced to do them and he could not say no.
Coerced from people higher up in the order in the military.
Yes, especially the former president, Jammeh.
Does the current government in Gambia support these trials of people accused of torture back in 2006?
Yes, the Gambia government also released a statement themselves. And as far as I know from the investigations, they've also worked hand in hand with the investigators to be able to help them get some of the evidence. Because prior to this, we also had a truth commission in the Gambia, which had witnesses and victims, and almost all the victims that were hired, they are the ones that are now the plaintiffs in these cases.
Mm.
Essentially, as far as I have seen, they're working hand in hand with the Gambia government.
Have any junglers been convicted in Gambia?
So unfortunately, no, we don't. And that those are some of the issues that we have. We do not have any jungler that has been prosecuted or at some point they were arrested. And if you could hear Korea in an audio recording in the court had said they started going after junglers. So he did not come back to Gambia because of those reasons. So the government did arrest. But then junglers are still roaming in the Gambia and there are people who see them. Some of their victims who see them and not just junglers. There are other people who had done wrong that are not just junglers that are still in the system. And so that is why we're hoping that the more that we get more UJ cases, the more that back home, they could also have more pressure to be able to try the people there. And they're trying to set up a special tribunal, a special prosecutor's office to start the trials. So far, they have not. But then we hope that very soon.
For now, it sounds like the venue for this is courts outside of the U.S. So what exactly does this particular verdict mean to you?
As much as I work as a journalist, I've also worked with civil society before. I do understand and I know how much victims need justice. And so even with interviews as a journalist and you talk to victims and see how some have lost hope, I think when you see this, for me, I think just as a human being, I'm happy that we at least have something. This is the best that we have. And I think it is sending a signal to a lot of criminals around the world that you do not just do something in your country and run to another country, hoping that it would be a safe haven. So I think the more that we get, the better.
Mariam Sankanu is a Gambian investigative journalist who covered the trial in Denver.
Negotiations between Israel and Hamas appear stuck again. Israel has reportedly presented Hamas with a Gaza ceasefire proposal, which the militant group rebuffed. An official from Hamas told Reuters that Israel's latest offer included a new demand for Hamas to give up its weapons. The official said that was the sticking point. Meanwhile, thousands of current and former Israeli military and intelligence officials have joined letter-writing campaigns calling for an end to the war in Gaza. The World's Matthew Bell has more on that.
As mediators from Egypt and Qatar met with officials from Israel and Hamas in Cairo earlier this week, the Israeli military continued its operations in the Gaza Strip. Mohammed Eragib, a displaced Palestinian, is holding a toddler in his arms. There used to be 150 tents here, he tells the Associated Press. This was Tuesday, and he was standing in a coastal area called Mawasi, where hundreds of thousands of Gazans are squeezed into a designated humanitarian zone. Israel carried out an airstrike there yesterday near a field hospital, killing a medic and wounding 9 other people. Where should we go? Eragib asks. Gaza's health ministry says the Israeli military has killed more than 51,000 Palestinians since the start of the war, and that includes more than 1,600 people killed since Israel ended the ceasefire last month. The war was sparked by the Hamas attack on October 7, 2023, that Israel says killed 1,200 people and saw more than 250 others taken into Gaza as hostages. Right now, 59 of those hostages remain unaccounted for. 24 are believed to still be alive. And getting them out safely as soon as possible should be priority number one, says Iran Duvdevani.
We must bring back the hostages, even at the expense of ending the war.
Duvdevani is 65. He spent 42 years in uniform as an Israeli paratrooper and later a special operations commander. He's one of more than 1,500 former paratroopers who've signed a letter in recent days calling on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to change course.
We have the feeling that the government wants this war to last forever.
At this point, Duvdevani says the war in Gaza is not about Israel's security or strategic interests. It's about revenge, he says, and it needs to end. As the letter he signed puts it, Netanyahu's government is, quote, motivated by personal and political interests. The letter-writing campaign began last week with a group of reservists in the Air Force. They put out a statement calling for a hostage deal and were then dismissed from service. That set off an extraordinary reaction. Military reservists and former service members from the Israeli Navy, Armored Corps, Special Forces, and intelligence agencies drafted similar letters. Ephraim Halevi is one of three former directors of the Mossad who signed.
The Gaza war needs to end because the way it's going on now does not promise any advantage we will get out of this. Netanyahu, for his own reasons, would like to carry this war on almost indefinitely. I think that's a very, very, very severe and serious mistake.
Halevi tells me the prime minister is dragging his feet because his far-right coalition partners are still warning him. If he makes a deal with Hamas to end the war and pull out of Gaza, they will quit and Netanyahu will have to face an election. Shira Ephron is with the Israel Policy Forum.
He doesn't want to go to elections because every poll shows that this coalition will not be established again. They're losing in every poll.
Ephron says another thing Netanyahu wants to avoid is accountability for what happened on October 7th.
This accountability usually in Israel comes with after a national commission of inquiry. And what the prime minister says, we can't have it while we're fighting, while we're in war. We can't expect officers to go fight when they're armed with a lawyer. So what it means is that ending the war will mean the appointment of a National Inquiry Commission, which will implicate the prime minister for his responsibility for the worst catastrophe in Jewish history since the Holocaust.
Defense Minister Israel Katz issued a statement today saying the government is working first and foremost to free the remaining hostages. He said Israeli troops will remain in parts of Gaza in the future, and that if Hamas persists in its refusal, operations will expand. Meanwhile, United Nations officials say that Israel's military operations, the blocking of aid, evacuation orders, and attacks on healthcare are, quote, driving what is likely the worst humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip since October 2023. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Online, you can find more of our reporting on the war in Gaza and the wider regional conflicts. We're at theworld.org.
Thousands of troops have been deployed to support customs and border protection along the U.S.-Mexico border.
It's kind of ironic that the military is here now because there's fewer folks crossing. A lot of it is auxiliary work, support work for Border Patrol.
That's reporter Gustavo Solis here at KPBS in San Diego, speaking with us yesterday about the military personnel in the area. We have now learned about the first casualties in that effort.
Two Marines from Camp Pendleton near San Diego were killed when their patrol vehicle overturned last night during a reconnaissance mission in New Mexico. A third Marine has been hospitalized. We'll keep following the news as the U.S. military joins immigration enforcement throughout the region.
A court in the UK is out with a controversial ruling today about the legal definition of woman. We'll hear how some in the transgender community are reacting ahead on the show. You're listening to The World.
Hey, this is David Rind. I'm an audio producer at CNN. And one of my favorite things about working at CNN is that I can call up our super smart correspondents and reporters whenever I want to pick their brains about the news and the stories they're covering. Well, I want to bring you in on those conversations with our podcast, CNN One Thing. Each week, I grab one of those said reporters and we break down one big story that's been making headlines. Again, the podcast is CNN One Thing. Listen on your favorite podcast app.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, the UK's highest court unanimously ruled on how the word woman is used in a law about equality. According to the court, woman is defined solely by biology. That means some provisions of the equality law at the center of the court case do not apply to transgender women, which has advocates like Jane Fay concerned about transgender rights in the UK. She's the director of the advocacy group Transactual UK. She told us the ruling is complicated and exactly what it means is not yet certain.
This is a big question, actually. I'd say the morning started with people absolutely in pieces, because as far as we're concerned, what it says is we are now to be excluded from UK society, but how far that exclusion goes, we can't tell. And frankly, there's two pieces of nonsense in that judgment that you read out. First and foremost, it is a lovely piece of Trumpian, I think Donald Trump used the same phrase, of Trumpian rhetoric to talk about biological sex. They have not defined biological sex.
Okay.
They've just put it out there as a soundbite. What do you mean by biological sex? Do you mean chromosomes? Do you mean that people have breasts or don't have breasts? Do they have a womb? All of those are questions. And the problem with that is it is now impossible to find a single definition.
So this case came out of Scotland, where the government argued that the word woman legally applies to transgender women with a gender recognition certificate. Can you explain the gender recognition certificate and what it does and doesn't mean here?
Yeah, this takes you back to how do you tell what somebody's gender is? And unless you're going to get involved in some very intrusive bits of biological testing, what we have tended historically to do is go by what it says on the birth certificate. What the Gender Recognition Act did is allow people to go back and retrospectively amend their birth certificate. And that is basically all it does. Now, alongside that, the legislation says that if you have a gender recognition certificate, you count as that gender for all purposes. And what this ruling has done, why it is very open to being challenged, is we have on one hand a piece of legislation which says that for all purposes, I am a woman. But we now also have a ruling which says, except when it comes to discrimination.
And so where do you see this going from here? It has already gotten all the way to the Supreme Court. So where do you expect clarity to come from?
We're back at the start, frankly. And what that means is that an issue that they may have thought was sorted out and decided 20 years ago is now back on the agenda. Because, yes, it is very bad for trans people today. But there are one of two routes that the UK government can take. It can go, well, you don't count anyway. We're not going to fix this. And I don't think we're going to go that route. I may be wrong. Or they're going to have to say, we're going to have to fix this. We're going to have to find a solution.
In the meantime, before clarity comes, what do you expect might be the changes to the day-to-day lives of trans folks in the UK?
It will probably ratchet up on-street transphobia. There will be people who interpret or misinterpret this ruling as giving them carte blanche to start excluding people.
Excluding people from, for example, women's sports teams or locker rooms or hostels, things like that?
No, the sports team thing has already happened. But I just don't know. I think it's going to get bad. I think it's going to get bad for those people who are out in public, because there are people who will see this as giving them carte blanche to just attack people.
The Equality Act does include specific protections for transgender people, including explicit protection from discrimination and harassment. The judge in this case pointed that out during the ruling. How do those protections fit with this decision?
We don't know. I mean, sorry, you're on day one. We've had lawyers looking at it all day. They're mostly saying this is bad news for trans people. Some of them are saying this appears to be totally inconsistent with previous rulings. But it needs clarification in practice.
Jane Fay is director of the advocacy group Transactual UK.
Diplomatic tensions between France and Algeria came to a head this week. Given the history of that relationship, going back to when Algeria was a French colony, the tensions are not new. But as the World's Sarah Birnbaum reports, these latest moves could sabotage what many hoped would be a reset between the two countries.
France has recalled its ambassador to Algeria and ordered 12 Algerian diplomats to leave Paris. That's a response to what Algeria did over the weekend. It gave French diplomats 48 hours to leave the country. But the standoff really began in July. Algeria was furious when French President Emmanuel Macron announced that he supported Morocco's claim to Western Sahara over that of the Algerian-backed independence movement, a position he reaffirmed months later during a speech to Morocco's parliament.
Pour la France.
For France, the present and future of this territory fall within the framework of Moroccan sovereignty.
A month after that, the French-Algerian writer Boualem Sansal was arrested when he was on a trip back to Algier on national security charges. He's an outspoken critic of Islamism and the Algerian regime. Macron said Algeria was, quote, dishonoring itself by keeping the writer detained. There were more episodes, but this is what has brought us to the diplomatic standoff we see today. Farida Souya is a migration expert at M. Lyon Business School in France. She says domestic politics in Algeria and in France are making everything harder.
Algeria is an authoritarian regime that tries to legitimate itself, and playing on the conflict with France can be used as a legitimation factor within Algeria.
The leadership, she says, plays up the crisis with France to distract from its own internal problems. And in France, she says, there's a new hardline anti-immigration interior minister, a man named Bruno Retailleau. Since he took office in September, he's made numerous hostile statements against Algeria, like accusing Algeria of trying to humiliate the French people.
Retailleau has played a lot on this specific issue, on the relations with Algeria, notably because he has for himself ambitions for the next presidential elections.
Algerians make up France's largest foreign community right now, about 2 million people. That's because of a 1968 agreement, which makes it easier for Algerians to live and work in France. Scapegoating them is a useful way to win political points on the right, Souya says. The two countries have had a strained relationship since Algeria won its independence in 1962, after years of brutal fighting. Souya says that history still weighs heavily on Algeria's collective memory. And in France, it's a history most would like to forget.
The French, in many ways, would like to sever completely this past and say, you know, let's start with a clean slate. But we cannot start with a completely clean slate because history is what it is.
She says there's a belief in Algeria that France never accepted Algerian independence. And that's why each new escalation adds insult to injury. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Gold is one of the top exports from the West African nation of Ghana, but illicit mining and smuggling operations have plagued the industry. Now the government in Ghana has created a new body to regulate the gold trade. Gavin Hilson studies the environmental and social impacts of West Africa's mining sector at the University of Surrey in the UK. He's seen Ghana's gold mines up close.
You could go to a site and there could be tens of thousands of people mining gold, not really taking any consideration about the environmental impacts of their activities. To the naked eye, it looks very chaotic, but it is extremely organized because you have people there being sponsored by other people who are being supported by others who are selling to specific people. So it is a very complex operation. And when you trace the supply chain, you may end up in Accra, you may end up overseas, you may end up in the village where the activities are found, and you may end up at sort of a traditional leader's palace. So a lot of the supply chain is shadow. It's very secretive. It's very difficult to sort of pinpoint. But when you study it close enough and study it long enough, as I have, you realize that a lot of the actors are right there in front of you.
Overall, how important is the gold trade to Ghana's economy?
There's over a million people employed directly in the sector. I would say there's close to 1.5 million. It's largely poverty-driven. It dovetails agriculture, so a lot of these people, when they're not mining, they're farming. And when they're not farming, they're mining. A lot of the revenue that's generated in gold mining is pumped into family farms, used to pay kids' school fees. So it's relied upon heavily by those 1.5 million people. And then you have to also take into consideration the activities that emerge on the back of gold mining. So I always tell people, you know, we always focus on the gold miners, but there's many more millions of people who are dependent upon them for their livelihoods. So the people you see at the site, every one of them has to be transported to the site. Every one of them has to be clothed. Every one of them eats. Every one of them lives somewhere. So for every person employed directly in the sector, he or she creates 6 additional jobs.
That's a really good backgrounder on the gold situation in Ghana. One can imagine that it's susceptible to corruption. But how does that corruption happen in such a way that this regulatory body has had to have been created?
Well, we have to sort of go back a few years and recognize that the reason why small-scale mining was legalized in Ghana was to stop smuggling. This is the ironic thing. And it was very effective. So around 2010 or the late 2010s, you had a proliferation of foreigners coming into the sector, registering as service companies and basically jumping into the Galamsey small-scale mining economy. That's what we refer to as illegal mining in Ghana. So you had a lot of these foreigners come in and they were sponsoring these small-scale miners. We have to remember that in Ghana, much like most of sub-Saharan Africa, over 95% of people in the small-scale mining sector are mining without a license or are mining in areas that are unlicensed.
I'm wondering if Ghana is focusing on cutting foreigners in particular out of the gold trade and perhaps ignoring well-to-do Ghanaians who are also transferring gold off the books out of the country.
A lot of the gold has been smuggled out of the country. So on the one hand, they do want to push out foreigners because obviously this has been a big issue, people smuggling out gold from the country. But on the other hand, I think as with most stuff that's being done with regards to small mining in Ghana, whether it's military sweeps of so-called illegal mining communities, trying to address the environmental problems linked to informal mining, a lot of this is being done to appease the foreign investor in large-scale mining. They want to show that they have things under control, which they don't, but these types of things show the world that the Ghanaian government is addressing the informal slash illegal mining problem when it comes to large-scale mining, because large-scale miners want to come in and they want to invest and they want to acquire lands to potentially develop.
I'm curious, Gavin, how do people in Ghana, like the average Ghanaian, how do they view their gold sector and how much of it isn't on the books? Because there's pride in Ghana around its gold, right? It used to be called the Gold Coast.
It's not very positive, to be perfectly honest, but I mean, a big problem is that people aren't asking the right questions. These people in the small-scale mining sector, they're not stupid. I mean, they know that mercury, when it methylates, is toxic. They know that they're drinking water that's polluted, but they have no choice to some degree. Miners don't help themselves, sure, but at the same time, is there a route to formalization? So protesting in the streets and talking about the environmental impacts of small mining without asking the question, why is this happening? How has this come about? I think we're really not doing the right thing here. We really need to think more dynamically about the situation and this particular issue. And we're not doing enough of that. I mean, protesting and talking about environmental problems and environmental impacts, et cetera, we got to address them, sure. But there's 6 million people who could be dependent upon this sector in the country, 25% of the population. They got to do something. So let's think about how we can formalize it, think about how we can regulate it more effectively. And the way you do that is by making sure that there's a route to get a license.
Gavin Hilson studies the environmental and social impacts of mining in West Africa. He's at the University of Surrey in the UK.
The biggest whaling company in Iceland has canceled its hunting season for 2025. It is the second year in a row that the Kvalr company will not participate. Whale hunting is controversial. The company says their decision, though, is purely economic. Sigurdur Johannesson at the University of Iceland explains.
Apparently, they don't make enough profits from their whaling. It's a financially strong company, but their strength comes from the past, when whaling was much more profitable than it is right now. They are only allowed to export their meat to a couple of countries. It's to Norway and to Japan. And their main market is Japan, and that market has been dwindling.
Right. Prices have dropped in Japan, which is what makes it not profitable anymore for this company. Why is that? Are people just choosing not to eat whale as much in Japan?
I guess so. And also, they are now catching their own whales.
Right, because Japan reintroduced its own whale hunt a handful of years ago.
Yeah, but I think the sales of whale meat has been going down in Japan for many years. Although it's not just what has happened recently in Japan. The economics of whaling have not been very strong.
Whaling is divisive, with many conservation groups calling for the practice to be banned entirely. What are the attitudes toward it in Iceland?
It used to be very supportive of whaling, but it is different in recent years. I think it's maybe half and half, or maybe more people are against it than for it. It's divisive, as you said.
So this company backing out of this season does not mean the end to whaling entirely in Iceland. Is that right?
Well, I think the decisions of that company will decide much the future of big whaling. So if they are backing out, I don't think others will step in the near future. It's not over, but the future doesn't seem to be very bright.
Sigurdir Johannesson directs the Institute of Economic Studies at the University of Iceland.
Life along the U.S.-Mexico border is a constant reminder that political boundaries are both real and artificial. Laws govern how people go back and forth across borders, but air doesn't stop at the border, neither does water, and it turns out neither does music. The scene in Tijuana is a prime example. It's a Mexican city less than 20 miles south of us here in San Diego, and musicians there are much closer to trends coming out of the U.S. than they are to the vibe in Mexico City, the capital, some 1,700 miles away. But for some artists, that proximity to Southern California only amplifies a desire to proudly represent being from Tijuana, or TJ, as it's called here. So two Saturdays ago, I drove across the border to spend a few hours taking in TJ music past and present by crate digging in record shops not far from the main drag, La Avenida de la Revolución.
It looks really nice. There's some nice places to eat, nice places to go shopping.
My guide was Beto Arcos, a music journalist with a deep knowledge of Latin American pop music. He's visited TJ more times than he can remember. It was 11 a.m., still early for a Saturday, and the manager at our first record store, La Ciruela Electrica, the Electric Plum, he was sweeping the curb. When he finally opened the door, we were the first ones in, and, well, what can I say?
Wow.
Looks like we walked into a disc digger's gold mine.
This is amazing. Wow.
This is a classic rock band from the 1960s that everybody listened to. They were very popular across the country. And they were from TJ. I just learned this from the man here.
The man Beto was just referring to is Pedro Serrano, the owner of Casa Retro, who took us from the TJ music of the 1960s, like this band, Los Rocking Devils, to sounds of the 1970s. He put on one record by a band that played the Avándaro Music Festival, Mexico's answer to Woodstock, in 1973.
This is a Mexican band. This is from TJ.
This band was in Avándaro.
I mean, the message that they have, it's very subversive. So this kind of band, you know.
Well, the band is called Peace and Love.
It's called Peace and
What's
Love.
What's subversive about
they
that?
They talk about going against the power, you know, fighting against the power. They're talking about, you know, drugs, marijuana, all that.
Yeah, there was definitely a period of horrendous censorship in Mexico after Avándaro, after 1973. And there were police raids all the time. They would, you know, take into jail. This didn't really, you know, this happened for more than 10, 15 years until the 1980s when things started to open up and you start to see the beginning of what became the Rock en Español movement.
What would you say is the role of pop music in Tijuana? I mean, Tijuana has like so much regional attention for its music, but what about the pop scene?
There's someone that actually has to do with Tijuana and people don't know, and that he's American. And he had a lot to do with pop music in the 1960s. I'm talking about Herb Alpert. He came one week into Tijuana with a friend to the bull ring to see a bullfight. And the sound that was coming out of the side, because there was, you know, the band that was playing not just Mexican music, they were playing pasodobles and all this brassy sound. That's what kind of triggered in him this idea for the Tijuana brass. He went back to Los Angeles. Next thing you know, he's recording this kind of Mexican influence sound. And there you have Herb Alpert and the Tijuana brass. One of my favorite singers from música norteña. Okay, this is like, he was, in my opinion, one of the best.
Who are we talking about here?
Lalo González, better known as El Piporro.
And is El Piporro kind of associated with Tijuana in some ways?
No, just the north in general.
Yeah.
But his stature, his place in history as a musician and as a singer is really the entire border.
Andándome yo paseando por las fronteras del norte, ay, qué cosa tan hermosa. De Tijuana, Ciudad Juárez, de Ciudad Juárez, Laredo, de Laredo a Matamoros, sin olvidar a Reynosa.
He's amazing, really amazing. And he sang all these songs that he had in his repertoire of kind of poking fun at life at the border.
Well, you were talking about one earlier, Chulas Fronteras.
Chulas Fronteras is really one of these songs where he takes apart the myth of working as an immigrant, working in the fields. And he talks about his experience going back and forth in the border. And he makes fun of that experience and the exchange that he has with the border guard. It's hilarious.
This is my picture. Un poco bigotón, but it's my picture. Bueno, sí, pero tú estás tomando. Because I have money, and with the money, dancing the dog, con dinero baila el perro, criatura. Échate un trago, no te vayas, Dios.
Oh. I found something from TJ here.
What is this?
This is Tijuana No. This is probably the hottest, the most well-known album of this band from TJ, Tijuana No. It's called Transgresores de la Ley, Transgressors of the Law. Oh my God, this goes.
And what was the track on here that really, like, hit big?
I would say probably Golpes Bajos, Low Hits. Oh, wow. How old is this record? This has got to be early 90s, mid-90s, but this is a reissue, so I'd have to look it up to see what year this came out. And here, of course, we have one of the great voices of Tijuana, who used to sing with Tijuana No, Julieta Venegas. This is probably one of her most pop-oriented albums that came out, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's called Sí, Julieta Venegas. She's dressed as a kind of somebody that's either going to get married or a quinceañera or something.
Or maybe somebody about to get divorced because she's, like, pulling on that glove.
That too. That, absolutely, that too.
What's a good track on this one to play, do you think?
I'm a sucker for this tune, Andar Conmigo. It's like, beautiful, very melodic. I just love the hook on that song.
Hay tanto que quiero contarte.
Decirme la verdad, eso nunca puede estar así tan mal. Yo también tengo secretos para darte y que sepas que ya no me sirven más. Hay tantos caminos por andar. Dime si.
I think Tijuana continues to be an important city in terms of its impact, in terms of the freedom, of the liberty that people feel coming to the city and being able to create whatever they want without, you know, anybody telling them, no, don't do this, don't do that, do it this way. No, everybody's free to do whatever they want. TJ, I think, has that history from going back, you know, decades.
Beto, it's been such a pleasure to go disc digging with you in Tijuana. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a lot of fun.
Estoy ansiosa por soltarlo todo, desde el principio hasta llegar al día de hoy. Una historia tengo en mí para entregarte.
Beto Arcos is a music journalist and author of the book Music Stories from the Cosmic Barrio. You're listening to The World.
Cualquier cosa, incluso darnos para siempre un siempre.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It's taken 3 years of debate, but World Health Organization negotiators in Geneva have reached a deal on how to confront a future pandemic. The pact needs to be ratified by member countries, but if they do, it will be legally binding. Agreement was reached as the U.S., by far the WHO's largest financial backer, withdraws from the organization. Tedros Ghebreyesus is the head of the WHO.
In the face of enormous challenges, you have come together, rising above borders and differences, united by a common goal, the protection of humanity.
Rachel Crockett is with the advocacy group Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative, and she joined us from London.
This is an incredible achievement in the context of what's happening in the world right now. Countries have come together and have agreed to work to achieve a better, fairer, more equitable outcomes when dealing with future pandemics.
We know that this deal is designed to ensure specifically fair access to drugs and vaccines globally. That was, of course, a massive problem at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. How exactly would that treaty address those issues?
So some of this stuff is real game changing, what they have agreed this week in Geneva at the World Health Organization. It's really a first of its kind treaty that if countries choose to implement it, which we hope they will, it could really reshape global health equity by ensuring that public funding of research and development for the drugs, the diagnostics, the vaccines that we all need when a pandemic hits, as COVID shows, this delivers public benefit. And we don't see what we have seen in COVID, which we are seeing with Ebola, which we are also seeing with Mpox, and that what happens is if countries are acknowledging that if they are funding research and development, if they are funding innovation into the health tools that we all need, that the public needs to have fair access to the resulting products that come from that funding.
And can you give me more specifics about what that exactly means? So if there's taxpayer money going into, for example, developing a vaccine in the US, what does that mean about public benefit that will be required under this framework?
Basically, in short, if a government, say the US government or any government, funds research, what this means is they can then put conditions on that funding that mean that in the case of a pandemic, when a pandemic hits, if the product is made from that funding, that that product is accessible to everyone who needs it, both for the citizens of that country, but also those around the world who need it, that it's affordable, that it's not priced out of reach to those who need them, and that actually it is developed at all. Because sometimes the right tools don't get developed for the right people. So these conditions attaching to the funding is saying that countries are saying that they're going to be in the driving seat for what they expect and what they're setting the expectations for what happens with their funding for research, and that they're no longer signing blank checks for research. They're actually taking control.
And I'll just say I use the example of the U.S. there, but of course the U.S. is in the process of pulling out of the WHO. So even if countries do agree to this treaty, you know, the U.S. would not be held to its provisions. I gather that one key sticking point in these talks is that the WHO will hold on to 20% of tests, medicines, and vaccines to ensure that poorer countries can get those supplies. That sounds like it would be difficult to implement. It would require countries to do this themselves, right?
So this has been one of the sticking points of the negotiation. So I'll use the example. South Africa discovered the variant Omicron in COVID. If they did that again and shared that information with the broader community, and a company chooses to take that information and develop a drug or a vaccine or a diagnostic from that that is then used, they then have to sign up to conditions for able to access that. That's ensuring a fair and equitable response to this.
Thank you for that example. That helps. I understand that another hotly debated issue was technology transfer. What does that mean in this context, and why does it matter, and how does the treaty address it?
So I think that the COVID pandemic really laid bare, I suppose, the consequences of failing to tie public funding to access. And without these enforceable conditions, governments that are investing in this research and development for these life-saving tools aren't able to really ensure that they're successfully developed and made available for their populations and everyone who needs them. And I think this issue of technology transfer, in simple terms, is just saying we need to be able to, in the case of a pandemic, share that technology widely across the globe so that we can make sure that there is enough vaccines produced and that they are produced in a geographically diverse way so that everybody who needs them around the world has fair access.
International agreements have serious limitations, though, almost always. In this case, even if countries do ratify this agreement, are there any teeth to get countries, companies to abide by its provisions?
I think every single international treaty and international law is obviously subject to the countries that are party to it, choosing to implement it at a domestic level. About this treaty, though, in particular, countries don't have to wait for the agreement's formal adoption in May to be able to take action. You know, they can and they should take action now. There are some real key provisions that can, if implemented, could be a game changer in the context of preparing for a future pandemic. And the real test is whether governments will take this really swift, concrete steps to develop these national level domestic policies and translate these commitments into meaningful impact.
The U.S. is withdrawing from the WHO. It did not participate in these talks. It probably won't sign this treaty. You know, much of the innovation when it comes to vaccines in the last pandemic came out of the U.S. It seems like the U.S. not being part of this treaty could have a pretty big impact on how efficacious it is.
Absolutely. In an ideal world, the U.S. really would be part of this and would choose to implement, either join the treaty or choose to implement some of the commitments regardless. What COVID has proven is that innovation is coming from a truly global space now. With COVID, we saw vaccines coming from Cuba, from Russia, from China, from the EU. And COVID has really stimulated a really truly geographical innovation ecosystem. And if a future pandemic hits, we don't know where the next vaccine, where the next therapeutic will come from. And I think that's why this treaty is so important, is that it's countries coming together to set the rules of the road, how they will act together in solidarity to ensure that the glaring, devastating consequences of COVID don't happen again.
Multilateralism is still around and kicking. Rachel Crockett is with the Advisory Group Drugs for Neglected Diseases Initiative. She's been speaking with us about a new global treaty to help combat future pandemics. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're glad you listened to The World. You can also look behind the scenes on Instagram. Our handle couldn't be easier to remember. We are at The World. Check out videos and images from our reporting all over the globe on Instagram. Again, super simple, at The World.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting today from the Catherine and James Whistler Studio at KPBS in San Diego. Special thanks to Nancy Worley, Lisa Jane Morissette, Rebecca Chacone, and the entire staff at KPBS for welcoming us warmly this week. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. by the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider, and Marianne Tagney. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.